spent a lot of time last week looking ahead to these three Leafs games against the Montreal Canadiens this week. And, you know, the wondering how the Leafs would approach this particular series, given that there is a very real chance, or there was a very real chance, and I guess there still is a very real chance, that they will end up facing the Montreal Canadiens in the first round of the playoffs. And, you know, we wondered how the Leafs would balance the desire to rest players, to get players sharp for the playoffs, to hold on perhaps to some strategic wrinkles that they may be prepared to run out against the Montreal Canadiens. Because God knows, I think the one thing we've seen this year, the Leafs have known probably for the last 3 months that they were going to face one of three teams in the first round of the playoffs. So if you really wanted to do a deep dive, and let's face it, there's a whole bunch of scouts that aren't doing jack anyhow right now. So if you really wanted to do a deep dive and break down teams, this is the year to do it. You know, the Leafs know which of the, you know, they have an idea now which three teams they will face in the first two rounds of the playoffs. So that was that. And my thought, Richard Deitch, and we talked about this, was okay. Well, you do, though. There is the small idea, though, or the small part of the equation that, you know, you want to sort of honor the competitive aspect of your game. You don't want to hand the Montreal Canadiens three games to allow them to clinch a playoff spot. And then, you know, the weekend goes on. The weekend gets played. Now, all of a sudden, Richard, you are the Toronto Maple Leafs. You're looking at three games against the Winnipeg Jets. The Jets are only two games behind the, you're looking at three games against the Montreal Canadiens. The Winnipeg Jets are just 2 points ahead of the Montreal Canadiens, which means theoretically now you might play Winnipeg and Connor Hellebuck in the first round. It is remarkable how it kind of changes all of a sudden, right? And I know the Leafs have played well against the Jets recently, but we talked about this. I don't know if you'd necessarily want any part of Connor Hellebuck in the first round. So it is going to be interesting to see how Sheldon Keefe and his coaching staff plays these next three games.
Yeah, I mean, out of nowhere, the fact that Montreal's sitting 2 points behind, 50 games in, Jets have lost six. It's pretty fascinating how that's all come together. I think if you're the Maple Leafs, Jeff, I think what you have to do is you ultimately have to play these games almost independent of who you might play heading forward. You rest who you want to rest. You play who you want to play. I think you do as much due diligence as one can to get players ready for that opening game in the postseason. You figure out goaltender rotation-wise what sort of works best for you, again, with an eye on, and I think at this point, Jeff, they have to know who they're going to start. I mean, they may not tell the public. In fact, they won't, but I would think Sheldon Keefe and Kyle Dubas and Brendan Shannon have an idea of who ultimately is going to start game one. So I don't even think you think about ultimately who gets that fourth seed. I do think, though, obviously, truth detector, lie detector time, I think you want Montreal as opposed to Winnipeg for the exact reason that we've talked about. I think the Jets just have more high-end talent. In particular, they have a goaltender who, if hot, can steal series. Although I will say that Connor Hellebuck and company scare me so much less now, Jeff, than they did even a month and a half ago. I do think the Jets are a very different team and heading in the wrong direction.
Yes, and there does appear to be, you know, some health issues with that team. You know, we'll have a better idea, I think, this week about where the Winnipeg Jets are, because you know Paul Maurice may be forced into a situation where he can't play coy with his injuries. Now, you know, I guess the good thing for the Jets is they it looks very much as if they will make the playoffs. I mean, I guess Calgary could still have a say in that. But it's funny because, you know, as again, we've talked about this a lot. I'm not certain if I was in the Winnipeg Jets, I'm not certain I wouldn't rather play the Leafs than the Oilers, given the way the Oilers traditionally, historically, have handled my franchise. But yeah, I'd like, you know, again, clearly if you're Winnipeg, I don't think you're not going to get too cute right now. But it is, it's the thing that I will be, you know, one of several things I'll be interested about in this series, and I think the thing a lot of fans will be watching, is just how Toronto approaches the edginess of this series. And what I mean by that is we have seen in the past 2 weeks, I think a pronounced and quite welcome change in how the Leafs go about attacking opponents. And I'm saying attacking, I'm talking about physically attacking them. And one of the things you know about the playoffs, right, is the playoffs, grudges get built up because you can play seven games in a relatively quick period of time. You see the same guy out in the ice in the same situations an awful lot. It's pretty easy to get the stink eye. And the same thing could happen in these three games. So I'll be fascinated to see the emotional level that the Leafs bring to these three games. And it's just, it's so odd that to be in this situation where you're, you know, we've talked a lot about wanting to peak at the right time and not wanting to peak too early, et cetera, et cetera. There's such an odd dynamic playing the same team so many times.
Yeah, I mean, where it changes for sure is like postseason scouting is, I'm not going to say it's irrelevant, but it's really reduced. Like at this point, you have so much data on these teams. You've played them so many times on the ice. I think ultimately, you know what the strengths and weaknesses are of each team. It'd be interesting if these teams can change up anything, but I mean, other than a change up in goal or other than maybe some line changes, not much is really gonna change. Your point though on Leafs just sort of being tough or more sandpaper is very true. And I think again, that's where the moves of, you know, Simmons and Thornton and Foligno, I think really have paid off in that they are a tougher team to play. I mean, you'd have to ask somebody in the league, like, to really quantify how much tougher they are to play against. But I just think the eye test shows you that they're tougher. They're around the net more, certainly on offense. I think on defense, they've been a harder team to score. I think Brody was a great, great pickup. Probably doesn't get enough credit for that move. So they're, at least as long as I've sort of been watching them now, whatever it is, 4 years or so, like they're in the best position I think they've ever been in heading into a postseason. And then, of course, you get the benefit of it's easily the easiest road you'll ever get to the semifinals of the NHL. I mean, the reality is, Jeff, they are the best team in the North. If form holds, they should win the division and get out. And then to me, you figure out everything you have to do over these next six games to have the best possible lineup for game one. And then knock on wood, I think it's going to be Jack Campbell and knock on wood that he comes to play for the playoffs.
Do you let Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, John Tavares, Morgan Riley, pick a name, do you let them decide whether or not they want to be rested at any point over final games?
Or do you tell them?
You take the decision out of their hands?
Yeah, because, I mean, there's a reason why great players are great players. And generally speaking, particularly young ones, great players are great players because they want to play. I think it's responsible management to protect your athletes from themselves sometimes, from their own bravado. That's not a bad thing, by the way. You need bravado to be a great hockey player, great football player, whatever. But yeah, I tell them ahead of time that we're going to give you a blow on this day. We're going to give you a blow on this day. And I would think, Jeff, even the ones who really want to play and sort of the whole ethos of hockey not taking off, I think there's got to be a part of those guys that also must welcome rest. I mean, it's a grueling sport. The mental energy that they've had to deal with playing all the stuff in COVID probably will never really know. Maybe 2021 was easier than 2020, but again, it's testing. It's abnormal. It's abnormal. No fans in the building. You're away from your friends, family.
The only thing is, Richard, though, I wish I could remember who said this on one of the panels this weekend. It was a fascinating point. They were talking about Leafs resting players. What are you going to do if you're a rested?
I don't know.
Leaf?
Do you would know this better than me. Like, you know, I know when I covered the NHL way back in the day, I would see some of these guys in the press box. But I think at this point, given COVID, you just Don't you well, just you hang
can,
out?
No, you
stay
can
home.
No, you can go into the no because there have been many shots of players in the you know socially distancing in the stands, wearing masks, watching games. You can do that, but that's
not a day off.
That's not a day off. Can't go out for dinner.
Yeah, I say
you know you can't. Take the dog for a walk down on the waterfront. Yeah. You can do that anyhow. That's the thing. I get that you a mental break is as good as anything, but man, if it just means you're going to be by yourself, I don't know. I'd almost rather be in the dressing room playing.
I get it though, but I think Jeff, I think a sports psychologist would sort of say that there's value in walking away from this for a day, like just getting away, thinking about something else. I don't know, fix up something in the house that you wanted to fix, go watch Netflix all day, whatever. But to me, that's got to be a value. And they are in an incredibly fortunate position where none of this matters, generally speaking, unless, I mean, somebody can do the math on this. I guess unless they lose six games in a row and Edmonton wins five of six. Like, the reality is they're pretty much locked in the first unless something crazy goes on. So,
and the Oilers are already talking about resting, you know, trying to figure out how to
rest McDavid and Draisaitl. Yeah. So to me, you got to do it. I mean, the only guy, here's my only caveat on this. The only caveat would be is if Austin Matthews is close to some kind of mark that he wants. I mean, maybe I'd listen as a reward for just how good a year he's had, but I would even try, if I was the coaching staff, to push back on that, because honestly, I don't really care what this guy does in the next six games. What you care about is what he does in the playoffs.
We will have the game tonight on Sportsnet Ontario. Pregame will be at 6:30, puck drop just after 7. The Leafs taking on the Montreal Canadiens. The Raptors, they play the Clippers tomorrow, or do they play the Clips tonight? I don't know.
I'll look that up there, but I think that is tomorrow.
Tomorrow. The Raptors coming off a win over the Lakers. Bizarre. Just a bizarre 24
understand.
Hours. I didn't watch the whole thing, but watching most of that game and then hearing LeBron James, finding out, first of all, that LeBron James is hurt. Now we know, by the way, that Dennis Schroeder's out for 14 days with COVID as a result of COVID protocol. And sort of hearing LeBron as much as say, well, he said that whoever designed the play-in should be fired. I actually kind of agree with him in that. But I didn't get the sense, Richard, that LeBron's... I don't get the sense LeBron thinks that it's going to be a coronation this postseason.
No, I mean, the Lakers in a couple months, Jeff, have gone from, you know, Vegas co-favorites or Vegas favorites, you know, back-to-back kind of possibilities to...
They might have to get him by the play-in.
Yeah, I mean, they probably won't, but they could if it really falls apart. They look terrible. I mean, they really... They do not look good. I mean, there's reasons for that, obviously, with their injuries. But, you know, Raptors came to play, and tip your hat to Pascal and Kyle for excellent games. But, man, like, just, I mean, if you just sort of, like, step back for a second, Raptors playing for, generally speaking, nothing at this point unless something crazy happens. Lakers really needing a win just to sort of, like, reset themselves. And Raptors go out and beat them pretty good. Very surprising. The if you are a Laker fan, man, you should be really worried if you're thinking about this year. This, Jeff, doesn't it feel like this is like a – this feels like a real hangover from all the work that they did last year where, I mean, you have to see what the playoff matchup is. But honestly, I would not be surprised if the Lakers get beat round one at this point.
No, and I will say this. I think last year we've talked about this. Fred VanVleet has talked about it. Bo Bichette's talked about it in a baseball point of view. I think last year was mentally wearing on a lot of really elite athletes. And yeah, I'm with you. You know, it's. I mean, my God, LeBron James. You know, in addition to what he had to do. We always have to throw the caveat out there that these guys are professional athletes. They're played well. Yada yada, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, LeBron James spent most of last year being a social spokesman, as well as trying to take his team to the title. And you know, it's something that it's part of the game for him. He embraces it. and good on him for doing that. And I would certainly never criticize him for doing that. But you know what, Richard, after a while, I mean, the brain's only got so much space, you know, and your body's only got just so many miles on it. I just think at some point it might just get too much for him. And I'm not saying LeBron's going to retire, because he's clearly not going to retire, nor should he retire. But I can kind of see if at some point this year he'd go, kind of give me a mental mulligan here, you know?
I mean, the guy has been essentially indestructible for his entire career for the most part. And, you know, you always think to yourself, okay, he's sort of like the one guy who's the true outlier. Like, he, you know, his body's incredible in his mid-30s, late-30s, and he doesn't get hurt. But, like, this is a year where I feel like reality setting in a little bit with him. He's obviously still a great player, but it does have the feel that the next couple of years for LeBron are going to be tough. Again, I would expect him to play. Even LeBron James at 80%, LeBron James is a great player, perhaps even an all-star player. But you have finally started to see a little bit of the indestructible LeBron fade. His game has changed too, and that's why Anthony Davis was a big help, that he could really carry the load. But it's clear that LeBron's suffering. And again, the Lakers just have the feel this year of one of those teams, like you said, like they're not in the bubble, but they're playing at the moment like a team that's really impacted sort of by this bubble environment. Now, my only sort of caveat here is LeBron James teams have a history, as Raptors fans know, of pushing the button once the playoffs start. So you really would never count him out. But there's no indication this year that the Lakers are a championship team.
No,
not at this point.
And I was going to say, there's no indication either that by pushing the button, well, this gets to what you said, you know, by pushing, if LeBron pushes the button, they still may not be good enough to get out of the first round. I mean, that's just on balance. They may not be as good enough. You think they regret not dealing for Kyle now?
I'm not sure there was a deal to be had. Like,
hey, let me rephrase that. Maybe not being more aggressive.
Yes, I do. Because I think Lowry would give them another significant scoring option. He would take some of the ball pressure off LeBron in particular. So it really would have been about, you know, was there more of, I mean, you really have to talk to Masai and Bobby, but like, was there more that the Lakers could have offered that would have change the Raptors' mind? I know Kyle's preference was Miami, but I'd have to think that to be a rental for the Lakers, even for a couple months, probably would have been something appealing to him. Just a guess.
Yeah, I think that's probably really well said. So let me give you an idea of what we have coming up in the show. Amy Trask is going to join us in a few minutes, and we will wrap up the NFL draft, which watched a bit of it Saturday. It was as much fun as the first round. I didn't hang in all the way through, but I think kind of sort of piggybacking on what Mr. Brunt said on Friday, it was just kind of fun seeing a whole bunch of people in one area have fun. It's like you sort of have to.
Yeah. No, Cleveland was so into it. Like, they had so much fun, those people there, which was nice to see.
Jovan Buha is the Lakers beat writer with The Athletic, and he will join us. We will discuss the aforementioned Lakers and talk about the Raptors 121-114 win on Sunday and the comments from LeBron James. Elliot Friedman joins us to get us set for this weird and wonderful final 2 weeks of this weird NHL season. A 425 Buck Martinez will be along. We'll take a look back at the Jays weekend sweep, look ahead to four games against the Oakland Athletics, and ask questions about George Springer and the pitching. Lots of questions surrounding the Toronto Blue Jays. Give them credit, though. 14-12, two games over 500. That with a pitching staff that in some instances has been held together by gum and rope, or gum and twine and string. So Buck Martinez joins us at 425. Amy Trask is CBS Sports NFL analyst. She's next. This is Writer's Block. the NFL draft has been concluded, and in addition to the usual questions hanging over who picked whom, when they went, and whether or not they'll be any good and how good they will be. That's probably a better question, whether or not they'll be any good, because that just seems a little nasty. The lingering question, or I guess the lingering, I don't know if we'd call it a cloud, the lingering issue? Richard, help me the right word here. We're talking about Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. What would you say? The lingering...
Well, I would say...
What?
They are relationship challenged at the moment.
Yeah. So the whole relationship between the Packers and Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is ticked off because he doesn't feel that he has been supported one. But the real reason, Jeff, obviously, is that, they drafted his heir apparent and mm-hmm. he has taken that significantly personally and now wants to move on from the organization. This will be a fascinating leverage play to see who has it.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to put it is it was the biggest story on the eve of the draft, and it's the biggest story now that the draft is over. Amy Trask, a CBS Sports NFL analyst, she joins us on Writer's Block. Amy, always good to talk to you. We trust you're keeping well. Before we talk about the draft in particular, I want to talk a little bit about the Aaron Rodgers Green Bay Packers situation, understanding that a lot of it has been source reported and I think in some cases there's a lot of putting two and two together, which is fine. It's kind of what we do in this business. But was this in some ways inevitable once Jordan Love was drafted, or do you think that either side, I should say, could have handled this differently?
Well, yes and yes, and thank you for having me on. I always enjoy chatting with you men. And to answer your question, I am well, but in the spirit of full disclosure, I am parked illegally so that I can be talking to you someplace where it is quiet. So if you hear me rev the engine and zoom off while we're talking, it's just so that I don't get a ticket, and I will give you play-by-play as I go.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. You use the word lingering, and that's a great word, and I like alliteration. So I will add to lingering that this has been looming. It is a large issue, and you referenced Jordan Love, and that begins with L as well. So lingering, looming, large, and love. Do I think that this has sort of been inevitable that it's come to this? Maybe not inevitable. Steps could have been taken to avoid it, but because those steps weren't taken, it was sort of inevitable. But do I think it could have been handled better? Yes, I do.
Amy, I don't know if you read Peter King's column today, but he talked to the Green Bay Packers general manager, whose name, honestly, I don't know off the top of my head. And it was interesting because the general manager smartly put out very, I would sort of say, vanilla language, obviously not to inflame the situation. But in reading that piece, it seems very clear that Aaron Rodgers is not going to report for whatever the early training that the team does. And from your perspective, as somebody obviously who is in a front office, like ultimately at the end of the day, if the player does not want to play, right, if the player makes a decision that I'm willing to deal with the negative press or fines or losing my salary for however long that will be, like, doesn't Aaron Rodgers ultimately have all the leverage here? Or am I mistaken? Maybe you see a way that the Packers do. But I almost feel like ultimately it's going to be a big game of leverage and chicken. And if Aaron Rodgers is serious about this, I think he's ultimately going to win and get traded.
Well, I think you're right. It is a game of chicken, if you will, and there is a game of leverage going on. What's particularly interesting in the case of Green Bay is it's the only one of 32 clubs without a traditional, and I say traditional in the NFL standard, ownership structure. So in other words, 31 teams are privately held by small groups of people. The Packers are publicly held, albeit not publicly traded on an open exchange. So, there is no one single owner who can walk to his GM or his president, CEO, head coach, this is what I want you to do. Get it done and walk the heck. I was going to say something else, but I won't because I don't want to get you in trouble with the regulatory authorities. But walk the heck out. In Green Bay, you have Mark Murphy, who's the president, but he reports to a small group of an executive committee. I don't know exactly the name of the committee, which in turn reports to a larger board of directors. So it's just a very interesting situation, not for all the reasons you noted, but because of the unique structure of the Packers. And of course, you know, Aaron was the host of Jeopardy. And I will say, as a fellow Cal Berkeley alum, he was the best host of Jeopardy. So irrespective of whether he wants to be the host of Jeopardy in lieu of playing, or perhaps he wants to do it in addition to, he's got that as leverage also, which is, hey guys, if I don't play, I don't play. I'm going to go to Hollywood.
Yeah, it's, boy, between that and the Deshaun Watson, although understanding that's a completely different situation, it's two really good quarterbacks that are kind of, their situations are up in the air in some ways here. Amy, looking at the draft, you know, watching that first round in particular, it was intriguing watching stuff kind of happen for Bill Belichick, and you know, having Mac Jones end up down where Bill Belichick could draft him. You've been in rooms during drafts. Do you get a sense very early in a draft whether it is going to quote unquote go your way? You know, is there such a thing as that? Because I know that everybody plots. You know, it's the same in every sport. There are scenarios plotted out and everything. But is there a point in the draft where somebody will look at somebody else in the room and they'll look at somebody else and go, okay, this is happening. This is kind of, everything's fallen our way.
Well, I was not in our draft room in any of my almost 30 years. I've got an answer for you. I just wanted, in the spirit of full disclosure, so I didn't mislead anyone. That's my law school background. Sorry, maybe I don't need to be so precise. But I wasn't in the draft room, but I was in constant contact with Al, who ran the draft room. And there were absolutely times where he would say to me, it's going our way, kid. It's unfolding as we had hoped it would. There would be other times he would say, you know, I'd be downstairs, he'd be upstairs, he'd grab me on the phone or otherwise and say, it's not going to happen. We're not going to get there. It's not unfolding the way we hoped or we thought. So the answer is, sometimes it does unfold the way you think. Sometimes it does not. But when it doesn't, sometimes it's better, sometimes it's worse. There is a lot of communication between and among teams prior to the draft. Some of it is miscommunication. Some of it is clear, honest, forthright communication. So I think in general, at least in my experience, teams have a general sense of what's going to happen. But yes, there are sometimes surprises.
Amy, how much pressure will there be in organizationally in places like Jacksonville or New York with the Jets, Chicago with the Bears, and maybe even New England with the Patriots to play these guys that they just drafted? And watching the NFL Network, a lot of predictions from those guys that Justin Fields would start day one. It probably seems obvious that Trevor Lawrence will go day one. But, like, I don't know. Are the days, like, long gone where you try to have a guy learn behind a veteran? Is the expectation now that all of these guys in some way are kind of expected to win the job?
Kind of sort of in between. You know, look, it's not the old days, the olden days, if you will. You know, kids, Google it. When you could sit someone for a very, very long period of time because the collective bargaining agreement changed over the last number of years, decade, you know, going back roughly to 2011. I think that was the year this change first went in, where free agency comes about sooner. So you can't sit people as long as you did. But look, you don't always want to have to start someone too soon because there is a value in letting someone learn. I think it's going to play out differently with different teams. Jacksonville, you pointed to, new quarterback, new head coach, new general manager. The owner has come out and said his legacy as to the Jaguars is going to be defined by this first round pick. Maybe we'll see him starting sooner than some others. I would anticipate not all of those guys are going to start day one. Some because they're not ready, some because team ownership is being a bit more judicious, and some because they do have someone in front of that person who can start while the new quarterback comes around. But you're absolutely right. You can't sit players as long as you used to. Look, Aaron Rodgers, who we started this discussion focusing on, and I just hate myself that I ended that sentence in a preposition. Mm-hmm. Does that count me as sort of your weirdest guest?
Oh, God, no.
Really? Okay.
Shoot. No, not even close.
Well, that's good to know, maybe. Aaron Rodgers benefited from sitting behind Brett Favre. But look, the day and age where you can sit someone for a long period of time is gone.
What did you make of San Francisco's draft and taking Trey Lance?
I was not as put off by it or surprised or dismayed, whatever word you want to use, as were many other people. They clearly saw an opportunity in that slot, to trade up and get one of a few quarterbacks that was exciting to them. And they used the time between the trade and picking to make sure they got the guy that they wanted. So many people were critical of that and said, well, if you didn't know before the trade which of those guys you wanted, then why are you trading? Well, I think that answer is easy. If you know there's going to be someone there that you love and you want to take your time to decide who you love the most, without having to worry that that person might be gone because someone else might trade into that spot, go ahead and do it. They were at number three. They got the guy who they wanted. Now let's see if it works.
Amy, I know you have been last year a pretty big supporter of Cam Newton and Cam Newton heading to the Patriots. How do you think that will work between Mac Jones, a guy who's clearly drafted to be what Belichick and company hope is the long-term quarterback, and Cam Newton, a guy who was once one of the bigger stars in the league, it sort of seems like still has the potential to like win you a certain amount of games. Do you want those two competing for the job in camp? If you're the Patriots, do you cut bait on Cam, given that it's not been a long-term relationship? How do you see that going?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, because I wanted to raise Cam when I was answering your question about the new quarterbacks, but I was yakking on so much about my poor sentence structure that I figured I better shut up. So I'm really glad you asked that, because no secret about it, I am a very, very, very big supporter of Cam. I think he's not given enough credit for what he does, not only on the field, but off the field. So total disclosure, I am rooting and cheering for his every success. And I think we have to remember that last year he was with a new team in a new system with a very, very odd off season, no mini camps, none of the usual preparation time that you really and truly need and want if you're moving to a new team into a new system. And oh yeah, by the way, New England had more opt-outs and then more free agent losses than any other team in the league. And, oh, by the way, Cam contracted COVID during the season, and that knocked him for a loop. So I don't think we saw what we will see this season from Cam last season. I am hopeful we will see a much better Cam this season. He'll have had a year in the system. Presumably he won't contract another virus, and he'll have had another offseason with Bill. So I hope he does really, really well and that they can bring Mac Jones along slowly. And then if they ultimately decide Mac's the guy going next, the year after this, then I hope that Cam proves himself so well this year he's got options for the following year.
Amy, as always, we appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Well, as always, I enjoy speaking with you, and I did not get a parking ticket.
Perfect. We have had a guest on this show get pulled over by the police in Quebec for talking on a cell phone while he was driving. It's a $400 fine.
All right. No laws as a moving vehicle. I was simply parked illegally. There's a difference. And
thanks.
I'm not saying your kids. I'm talking to the listeners.
Thanks, Amy. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Take care. That is Amy Trask, NFL insider, NFL analyst with CBS Sports. Didn't ask if she was eating an ice cream cone.
Who knows? California people are.
She does spend. She spends
living well.
She spends a lot of time staring at the ocean, and eating ice cream. Which I'm certainly not being critical about that.
Well, I mean, you work for the Raiders in a big time position for 20 something years, and now you got a TV gig. I mean, unless Amy was going out partying every night, some nice eggs in the bank there, I would think.
Jovan Buha covers the Lakers for The Athletic. You may have heard that the Raptors beat the Lakers 121-114 last night. Don't know what to make of it from a Raptors point of view. Really don't know what to make of it from a Lakers point of view, because I really got the sense afterwards that LeBron James is, I got the impression he's kind of getting tired. He's like the rest of us. He's kind of getting tired of 2021, I think. Just don't know if the rest of us have as much at stake as he does. Jovan Buha is next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Reminder, we will have Blue Jays baseball tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. First pitch is at 9:37, the first of four games between the Jays and Oakland A's from, I think it's called Ring Central Coliseum or whatever it is. I don't even know what Ring Central is. Why don't I just check to find out for sure? Because the damn thing has changed names like 1,000 times. It was McAfee, it was Oakland Alameda. I don't know, it was 3M or something like that. But I think it's now called Ring Central. I don't even know what Ring Central is. There you go, Ring Central Coliseum. Historically and often commonly referred to as Oakland Coliseum. There you go. 9:37 is the first pitch tonight as the Jays will take on the A's in the first of four games. We mentioned that the Raptors beat the Lakers last night. And both Deitch and myself, I think, are on the same page here. We just, wherever this Raptor season is going to go, just get there. I think that's kind of where we are. And I don't mean that in a pejorative. I really don't. I think, you know, the Raptors they got something in the works. There's some sort of plan in place here. So it's going to go where it's going to go. And we'll just go along for the ride as long as it lasts. And then, when the ride's over, we'll bid adieu to 2020-21 and wait to the next season. I don't know what to make of the Lakers, though. And more to the point, I guess, after last night's loss to the Raptors, I don't know what to make of the, I wasn't really introspective, LeBron James. I didn't know what to make of LeBron James's reaction to it and kind of his musings of as to where this team is and where it needs to go, and I don't know, maybe even where it can go. Jovan Buha covers the Lakers for The Athletic, and he joins Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Jovan, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. What you make of what LeBron, before we deal with Dennis Schroeder and LeBron's injuries and all that, just LeBron's mindset yesterday, you almost got the impression that it's not that he doesn't care, but you almost got the impression that he was preparing himself for a relatively early end to the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it best in your intro. You know, I don't really know what to make of the Lakers right now either. It's been such a weird season, and I think there was this sense that as long as Anthony Davis and LeBron James returned, everything was going to be okay. You know, those two were going to normalize and stabilize things. And as long as they were back by the postseason and, you know, relatively healthy, the Lakers are going to be okay. But that hasn't been the case. They are 1-5 since Anthony Davis returned and 0-2 since LeBron returned. And, you know, no disrespect to the Raptors, but the two losses to lottery teams in the Kings and the Raptors. And, you know, I think Toronto's better than that, you know, had the season gone a little bit differently with health and COVID protocols and stuff. But still, I mean, the fact of the matter is, like, it's not like they lost to the Nets and the Jazz or the Sixers or the Bucks or whatever. Like, they lost to the Kings and the Raptors in a stretch of games where, you know, every game matters for the Lakers. And I think what's been most jarring overall has just been, I think, kind of to your question, like this lack of urgency from you know, just the team and sort of, you know, the Raptors were the hungrier team last night. Like the Raptors look like the team trying to stay out of the play-in game, even though they're obviously trying to make the play-in game. Whereas the Lakers, like, just didn't have that sense of urgency. And I think people have been focusing on LeBron and AD's comments, but I thought Kyle Kuzma had some of the spiciest comments last night, where he said, you know, we're disconnected, we're unhealthy right now, we're not on the same page, there's a lot of stuff going on, this year is different than last year. Like, he had some quotes that I think didn't get maybe the proper attention that they deserved, because I thought there was a lot of revelation in some of those things. So I think this is the nadir of the Lakers season right now, and it could certainly get worse if they lost in the first or second round. But I think they're in a really interesting spot, and I'm fascinated to see where they go from here.
You see the West a lot more than we do. You know, we've been focused obviously on the Raptors, and you are correct. It has been a weird year. I mean, team with a plus minus differential that's a plus with their record, you don't see something like that often. If the Lakers, if we sort of project a little bit, and let's say the Lakers are somewhere between, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, given what you've seen in the West, like, how confident are you? How do I sort of phrase this? Yeah, you know, it's hard to knock out a defending champion, generally speaking. And a lot of these teams in the West are still, in my opinion, kind of unproven. So I guess what I'd ask you is, where's your confidence index if the Lakers are sitting at a very low seed against one of these teams that's sitting first, second, or third, for one of these teams to actually do it and actually knock them out?
I would say that my confidence level in them getting knocked out is still relatively low, but it's increasing by the day. You know, like I thought, last night, or just yesterday in general, I mean, you just look at the dominoes that happened. You have Dennis Schroeder get ruled out for 10 to 14 days due to the health and safety protocols. They get waxed by the Raptors. I mean, that was a blowout. I know the final score was 7 points, but, you know, that game was not as close as the final score indicated. You have LeBron exit the game with his sore right ankle, and then you have multiple players kind of with these, you know, wild quotes post-game and just sort of the team clearly being disconnected. So I think you combine all of that, and that's where I think a lot of the concern comes in, where it's just, you know, on paper, I mean, there's a reason this team was the proverbial favorites entering the season. You know, everyone was picking them to repeat. Everyone's been picking them to repeat basically until the last few weeks, where I think some of the confidence waned. And of course, the Nets have looked really, really good, and I think they should be the favorites as long as they're healthy. But I think for me, like, I still have a hard time. Like, I mean, I'm looking at it. They play the Nuggets in the first round. Am I really going to pick the Nuggets to beat them? Like, no, I'd still pick the Lakers. But I think if they were healthy, I'd probably pick them maybe in like 5. But with the way things are looking, that's probably a 7-game series, right? If they play the Clippers, that's a tough one. I mean, I might have to pick the Clippers with the way they've played this season. Like, so I guess it depends on who they play. I would probably pick them over any team in the West right now, other than the Clippers. I think the Clippers would be a tough one, and I'd probably lean Clippers in that one. But I mean, I think it's more so if they get to the finals, it would be tough not to pick an East team. I think especially the Nets, like they just, you know, the best version of the Nets this season has been better than the best version of the Lakers. But to your point, there's this kind of this cognitive dissonance where, you know, on paper and with what we know, with what we saw in the bubble last year, the Lakers just looked unbeatable. But that was also a different version of Anthony Davis. And we've seen that version of LeBron this year. You know, I've written it a couple times. I thought that before his injury, I thought he was smack dab in the middle of that MVP race, had a really good shot to get his fifth MVP. But we have not seen the bubble version of AD this year. And I think that more so than, aside from the health, which of course they need health to win the title, they're not going to win it without it. It's just Anthony Davis has not been Anthony Davis. You know, he has not been the bubble version of himself. He hasn't really even been the regular season version of himself last year with the Lakers. And until we see that version of AD, it is hard to have full confidence in this team repeating. And I think it just kind of feels like one thing after another. And that was kind of the disappointment, I think, yesterday kind of could have been an opportunity to right the ship, get back on track, start some momentum, start to ramp up. And instead, it's like, you know, now Dennis is going to probably miss the rest of the regular season. LeBron is going to miss a few games. Like, I just don't know how they overcome that. At some point, I think it becomes too much.
almost makes you think Kyle Lowry might have fit in there.
I mean, look, that felt like you should have traded for me game, right? Like,
yeah.
he torched that. Like, and the way it wasn't, I don't see every Raptors game, but it wasn't just the way that Kyle, I mean, he was hitting some ridiculous shots and then obviously had a great game, but it was also the celebrating, right? Like, and it was the gesturing and a little bit of the showmanship that it felt like there was a little bit extra there of like, this is what you guys could have had. And you didn't pull the trigger and you didn't trade for me. So I'm going to show you what you could have had. And that's how I took his performance yesterday. And it was really fun to watch.
Yeah. One thing about Kyle Lowry, man, the old don't poke the bear thing, when he's been poked. And I've always loved it about Kyle. And he is the one Toronto athlete I've seen that he's well aware of who he's playing. Let's just put it that way. He is well aware of who he's playing, and he's not afraid to throw a little extra edge into games. That's why we like him so much. Jovan, thank you for doing this, man. Great insight.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Take care. That is Jovan Buha, covers the Lakers for The Athletic. I think I'm right in that, right? Kyle's got a sense of the moment. There's a little bit of that in him. There's a little bit of the bleep you.
The doctor, he knows. The great thing about Kyle Lowry is Kyle Lowry, there's 20 things going on with Kyle Lowry, and he's probably going to tell you like less than half of one. He absolutely knows
right.
What's going on. He understands the moment. He does things. I love him as a player, but he is absolutely, Jeff, what's the word I'm looking for? Scripted is not the right word I'm looking for, but
calculating.
He's calculated.
He is calculating.
That's the perfect. He is as calculated an NBA player as it gets.
Yep.
But I would say the best players in the league, LeBron, Chris Paul, they're all these guys are calculated. Kevin Durant, they know exactly what they're doing. And yeah, I think Kyle steps up. I think Kyle picks his moments. And the interesting thing for the Raptors, I'm sure we got a long time to talk about this one, but Kyle Lowry athletically, he's not getting any better, but he's not getting any worse. And that's what they're going to have to decide. Like, you know what I'm saying? He's not going to age the way other point guards age because his game's not based on speed. And they got an interesting decision coming up.
Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and 31 Thoughts joins us. How do the Leafs play these three games against the Canadiens? I know how they play it, but you know what I mean. This could be the team that they face in the playoffs. How do the Leafs approach this? Elliot Friedman will give us some insight. This is Writer's Block. The Leafs will take on the Montreal Canadiens tonight in first of three games between the teams, part of this bizarre COVID-necessitated Scotia North division. And much of the discussion, of course, in the last week or so leading up to these games has been how the Leafs might approach these three games. They may face Montreal in the first round of the playoffs. They may not. It may be the Winnipeg Jets they get. We've talked about players wanting to rest, maybe hit individual milestones. Finding that fine balance between being rested and sharp and not wanting, I would think, to show any new strategic wrinkles you may have planned for the first round. I mean, there's just so much going into this. These teams have seen each other so often, and now they get a chance to see each other, one last glimpse of each other over the course of a few days before they start the playoffs. We will be joined in a few minutes by Elliot Friedman, Hockey Night in Canada, and 31 Thoughts, of course, co-host of the NHL on Sportsnet. We talked about this a little earlier, Deitch. It is going to be interesting to see how Sheldon Keefe handles this, how he handles the workload. I guess if you really want, you can give your players, you can get through these three games and then maybe give your guys a blow next week with the final two games. It just seems like this is just such a weird situation.
Let's not bring the word load management into the NHL.
Load management existed only before tough guys Kawhi,
lose
though.
Tough guys lose teeth and play 90 games. I mean, it's just smart, sound sports medicine. Give these guys a blow. These games are meaningless for the most part.
Yeah, it's almost like people think load management was invented by the Raptors with Kawhi. Going on forever. Yeah. We just didn't give it a fancy name.
Exactly. Right. You don't think, Ty Cobb got a day off to drink or something? I mean, you know, I don't know.
Maybe a day off from drinking.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying. This stuff's been going on forever.
Yeah, it's like oh my God, load management, that never existed. Yeah, it did. We called that a day off. Let's bring in Elliot Friedman, Hockey Night in Canada, and 31 Thoughts, the podcast. So how do you think Sheldon Keefe plays these three games, Elliot?
It's a good question. I guarantee you there's going to be some guys who are going to say, you know what, I don't need the time. Especially because depending on, you know, when the playoffs begin in Canada, we might be a couple days delayed. We'll see. I think if anything, the load management might come during games. Do Matthews and Marner and guys like that maybe get one or two less shifts than they normally do? I think you could see that. I think we've seen evidence of that already. One of the things I thought was really interesting was in Saturday night's game late, when it was already decided they got a power play and they sent out the first power play unit. And I didn't have a huge problem with that because the man advantage that hasn't been great this year. And they also, didn't have a power play on Thursday. And I think that was their first one on Saturday. But I wonder if we get to a situation where, you know, they're later in games and it's decided some other guys get a chance to play on it. That's what I would expect to see a lot more is, you know, do we see more in-game rest as opposed to you don't play rest?
Elliot, the most interesting thing to me, I think, when it comes to – I mean, there's a lot of things obviously interesting about the last six games of the season and how they play the Canadiens, but the real one is goaltending. And these guys are obviously very, very smart and very analytical driven. So I would assume that they have it charted out as to who they want to play in net for all the games. And then I'm sure they take the calculation in terms of, okay, if the playoffs get started later, you know, how do we factor that in? Particularly, let's say if you want to keep a guy fresh, do you give him that last regular game of the season? This is my long preamble to ask you, as I always like to ask you on the show. Has anything changed in your opinion when it comes to the decision-making process between Jack Campbell and Freddie Anderson, let's say over the last week or two?
No, I don't understand how, I have a saying I use right now, Richard. What's in this day and age, what's true now might not be true in 15 minutes. So you've got to be careful with bold predictions. But I don't understand how you could look at the situation right now and say anybody but Jack Campbell is starting game one of the playoffs. All things being equal, everybody healthy, you know, Campbell's your guy. I think the one thing I'm looking at here is, they can send Anderson on a conditioning stint to the Marlies. And I got to think they're looking, I think the maximum they can do is 6 days or three games. It's something like that. I don't have it right in front of me, but it's something like that. I'm sure they're going to back time it to, okay, these are the three games that we think are the ones that make the most sense for Freddie Anderson to be ready for the playoffs. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's possible if something like that happens with Riley Nash too, so he can get some games going if he's ready to go. So that's the way I look at it. I think Campbell's the guy. If assuming nothing changes, I don't understand how it could be anyone but that. But I'm thinking Anderson gets conditioning games in the American Hockey League, so at least he sees a hockey puck in a game-like situation.
Okay, this is another one of those questions.
Okay.
Who do the Leafs want to play in the first round?
You know, it's funny. Our producer, I'm working the game tonight against Montreal in the regional, and our producer, David Azuma, he has this awful segment called burning questions. It's just a burning pain in the butt is what it really is.
Yeah, ESPN did burning questions like about 20 years ago. I think it's time. I think what we need to do, it's time for everybody in the media to come up with something different. Burning questions is done.
I think David's only about 14 years old, so maybe he wasn't alive for that segment on ESPN. But, you know, I think that one of the things he's going to ask us tonight is going to be that. And, you know, look, I think they've handled Montreal pretty well a lot of this year. First of all, I think if you're them, the way you've played this year, you're going to be confident no matter what. They've been consistently the best team in the division with a lot of injuries and a lot of things that could have derailed them. And I think I give them a lot of credit for that. But I look at that, I got to think they've played Montreal really well. You know, Montreal is really banged up too. Now Gallagher is skating. I think he's going to be ready to play. Weber had a unique thing this morning where he's a right-hand shot, but he was skating and he was using a left-hand stick and not using his injured hand. And, you know, I'll tell you this, I'd heard that there was a chance that Weber could be out for a long time. And somebody warned me against saying that because this is Shea Weber you're talking about. And if he has any chance of playing, he's going to play. I think Montreal could be a real handful in the playoffs simply because I think they're kind of built for that kind of game. But I think if you're the Maple Leafs and you've played so well against them, you're comfortable playing them. And I will admit, Jeff, there's a selfishness here. We are due a Toronto-Montreal series. So I kind of want to see it happen just because it's been too long in our lifetimes that the Maple Leafs and the Canadiens have played in the postseason.
Elliot, what do you hear on Jake Virtanen and the investigation that's happening either by the league or by the team?
All I hear is that it's basically just started. You know, like I just want to be really careful, Richard. I don't think guessing or pontificating serves anyone well. And you know, obviously, this came as a big surprise to a lot of people the way it came out. And you know, I think they're going to let the investigator deal with this and see where it takes them. But I don't know if anyone's expecting this to be quick.
What do you most want to see? I'm going to say resolved. I don't know if resolve is the right word, but what most intrigues you about the Leafs in these final 2 weeks? You know, is it sort of seeing where Rasmus Sundin fits into things when this is all done? What is the thing that you think could be the most interesting wrinkle here?
Well, I think to me it's, you know, like if you're Galchenyuk, you look at your practice the last couple of days before the Vancouver game on Saturday, and, you know, you're suddenly off the second power play unit, and he'd been struggling a little bit, and you've got to be looking around and thinking, oh boy, when Zach Hyman gets back, that could be really bad for me. Now I'm off the power play. And they have a lot of bodies. They have a lot of guys who can play. You know, Hyman will be coming back at some point. Bogosian will be coming back at some point. Riley Nash will be ready to play at some point. You know, all of a sudden, Adam Brooks is stating his claim to a regular spot on the roster. That is going to be the most interesting thing to me is, because I believe, like, you can't fool the players. They know who's supposed to be in the lineup. And I think, you know, Sheldon Keefe, even though he gets a lot of, you know, a deserved credit as a new age guy, I think he's also a results guy. And he's going to look at it and he's going to say, this player has dictated to me that he deserves to be in the lineup. So, you know, there's probably about three or four guys who are looking at this and they're sweating a little bit. And they're saying, boy, game one of the playoffs against either Montreal or Winnipeg, I don't know if I'm going to be in. So what is that player going to do over the last few games to show that they deserve to be in?
Elliot, I saw that the Seattle Kraken are free to make trades and sign players now that the final expansion payment exists. That's really interesting to me. Like, how you got a sense of like how active they'll be in the near term?
Well, one thing I'm curious about is, when Vegas signed their first player, they signed Reed Duke, who Brad McCrimmon, the GM, knew very well. Kelly McCrimmon, the GM, knew very well from his days in Brandon with the Wheat Kings. And they signed him and made him the first Golden Knight. I'm very curious to see if Seattle's going to do something like that. And, you know, they have two junior teams in the area, the Thunderbirds and the Everett Silvertips. And there are a couple of players there who are overage, undrafted kind of thing. And I'm wondering if they do that. Like, Seattle seems to me like the kind of team that would be like aware of that to say, this might be a really good PR move for us to make our first player somebody with a good Seattle connection or a Pacific Northwest connection. I think they've already been pretty active. They couldn't formally do anything yet, Richard, but there's no doubt in my mind that heading into the trade deadline, there were teams calling Seattle and saying, look, if we have to do this, will you help us out with this? Or what would it cost us to avoid you doing this? You know, I know some of the teams that were thinking before Nashville pulled them off the market, Matthias Ekholm, like there were some teams who were looking at him and saying, okay, we're going to trade for him, and then that's going to cause us an expansion problem, so we might lose something twice. And I believe some of those teams were in contact with the Kraken and saying, all right, if we get this player and it means we have to do this, expose this or keep this, what's it going to cost us to get out of our problem? I also do think that because Seattle have a ton of cap room, Richard, I think there have been teams of calling them and saying, if we leave this player exposed or we want you to take this player, what incentive are we going to need to include to get you to do that? I definitely feel that's been going on, even if only now can it officially really happen.
Elliot, I mean, this is really good news that Tyler Seguin has been activated.
You see the video? I just read.
Yeah, I did. As a matter of fact, I just saw the video.
Fantastic.
It's remarkable. What does this do to their chances now? They're what? They're 3 points back of Nashville, I think.
With a game in hand. They had a huge game on Saturday night. Nashville won 1-0 in overtime. The Predators celebrated like they just won a playoff round. Like, that was a grind of a game. It was a real hard-fought playoff intensity game. Now, the odds favor the Predators simply because of that win, 3 points up with the game in hand. Also, Nashville has back-to-back with Columbus this week, and Dallas has to go in to play Tampa and Florida. So Dallas's schedule is a lot tighter. You know, they have a lot of trouble scoring. They play really hard, but they have a lot of trouble scoring. You know, Seguin can obviously, at his skilled best, is definitely able to help that. I'm just wondering, you know, it's always hard when you've been off the ice for what's the end of September until now? 6 months?
6 months.
When you've been off that long and then you get thrown in to 90% of the season's done and everybody else has been ramped up. Like, I'm sure tonight there might be the added, you know, energy, it'll all be there. He'll be wired. He'll be ramped up and ready to play. I just think it's really hard when you've been out this long and everybody else is at full throttle. It's a big challenge, but I'm happy to see it and I wish him the best.
Elliot, Connor McDavid has 87 points in 49 games. That's a 145 point pace for 82 games.
Yeah,
where do you put that accomplishment, especially given we are in a abnormal season where guys, I think, have had to have mental challenges that are certainly unique to the COVID era?
I think it's incredible. I think it's absolutely incredible, Richard. I think that he's like, you know, I believe that, you know, McDavid has one Hart Trophy already, and I think he wins a second this year. But I still think he doesn't get enough respect in the voting. I've been saying this for years. I think he gets shafted in the voting. And this year will make up for it. I don't know if he's going to be, there's 120 voters, I think it's 100 voters this year, Richard. I can't see it being unanimous. I just think that there's always going to be somebody who's an outlier or someone's going to feel differently, which is fine. But I would be surprised if it wasn't a landslide. you know, it's like Ovechkin scoring at the pace he scores at, or Matthews this year scoring at the pace he scores at. It's really hard to score in this league. The teams defend really well. They scout each other really well. And as you said, this season has unique challenges to it. You know, I got to tell you, I think it's phenomenal. I think he's going to be the MVP, and I think he 100% deserves it. And to be honest, I don't know if he's appreciated enough for how good he is. Like you know, people go out there and say, nobody plays defense in Canada. It doesn't matter. That guy would be scoring at will almost no matter who he played against. He's that good.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but, you know, there's when you watch Connor – I wouldn't even say watch Connor play, but when you sort of absorb the discussion around Connor, I almost think that we're now at a point where he's kind of like Sidney Crosby in that his brilliance is just accepted. Even though I think, look, Sidney Crosby's a great player. Connor can do different things, different offensive things than Sidney Crosby does. But Elliot, I think you're right. I think you just kind of look at Connor McDavid and go, oh, yeah, you know, and I think maybe there may be that aspect. Whoever challenges him going forward for the MVP award, he's always going to be kind of viewed as the Sidney Crosby, just the guy who is always there, you know?
He's always there. You're right.
And that works against you sometimes.
We take it for granted. Yep. You know, I think that a lot of the best players in a lot of sports, they get taken for granted over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that McDavid, I think over the last couple of years, I think he's been ridiculously low in some Hart Trophy voting, and I think he's going to make up for that in a big way this year.
Yeah. Friedge, we're going to let you scoot, man. Great of you to do this. Have fun tonight.
All right, guys. Have a great day.
Thank you. That's Elliot Friedman of Hockey Night in Canada and 31 Thoughts, the podcast. And again, he will be on our regional coverage tonight. Leafs and Canadiens as first of three games between these two teams, and then two teams that it kind of feels, I mean, this is awful given where we are in the standings, but doesn't it kind of feel to you, Richard, as if Montreal and Toronto is going to be the first round matchup? They they could catch Winnipeg, but don't you get the sense this has been kind of working its way towards Leafs and Canadiens for the past couple of months?
I do, because I think the Leafs are going to take at least two out of three of these games. And I would just think eventually the Jets are going to have to win a couple of games. I mean, I can't see them losing their last 11 or 12. But, you know, let's say Montreal wins tonight. Gets interesting. I mean, Jets would be in free fall. Canadiens would be there. Yeah, but I've always thought that this would be the matchup. And
just kind of felt,
I think
like
it's a very good matchup for the Leafs. I mean, I think this is who you want in round one.
Yeah. Oh, I'm with you. I think this is best case scenario for you. I mean, I'll tell you what, it's a better case scenario even than having the Ottawa Senators somehow make the playoffs. Yeah, I'd rather have Montreal.
I would rather not see them. They seem to play up for the Leafs.
So yeah. So I think,
wouldn't mind seeing them.
I think you're right. Buck Martinez is our Blue Jays voice on Sportsnet. The Jays are in Oakland tonight for the first of four games at RingCentral Coliseum against the Oakland Athletics, coming off a sweep of the Atlanta Braves. Buck Martinez is next. This is Writer's Block. Right, we'll have Blue Jays baseball tonight, 9:37 first pitch from RingCentral Coliseum. Lovely RingCentral Coliseum in equally lovely Oakland, California. The Jays and the Oakland Athletics, the first of four games. Jays coming off a sweep of the Atlanta Braves in Dunedin. We got to see George Springer play, or rather we got to see him DH. It was exciting. Saw a couple of home runs. And we also got to see George Springer take himself out of yesterday's game as a result of fatigue. Now, I made the point on Baseball Central. In this day and age of analytics and high performance and all that, we just to maintain one's sanity, one needs to view these things as being folks with a lot more information than we have making decisions, or players with a lot more information than we have and a lot more voices in their ears than we have making decisions for the better. I don't think anybody, I just assume everybody wants the best for everybody in this thing. I do find it odd, though. I'm going to bring Buck Martinez and our Blue Jays voice on Sportsnet. And Buck, thank you for doing this. And look, I just kind of assumed it was going to be, we were going to see George Springer play for a bit, and then he might need some time off, and then he'll come back. Because I think teams are really being careful with how they bring players back this year. But, you know, I thought George Springer would DH a game. Then we'd see him in the outfield. And my question, Buck, is if he's not good enough to play in the field right now, should he be in the lineup? Like, I know he makes the lineup better. Obviously, it's a better team with him in there. But shouldn't we have just kind of waited until he was able to be George Springer center fielder or George Springer right fielder?
Well, that's a great question. And as you said earlier and stated so perfectly, that people with a lot more information are making these decisions. But I don't think Springer's playing tonight. I think they're keeping him out, and I think they had planned on not playing him tonight, and they were hopefully to play, the entire homestand and feel pretty good about himself. But I saw it the first two games ago when he went down the line and grabbed the right leg, and I mean, he felt something in there, and obviously he's not 100% yet. So they're really going to leave it up to him, and it's up to him when he's going to be good enough. And he, like I say, I don't believe he's playing tonight. Hopefully we'll be back at DH tomorrow, but I think it's going to be a while before we see him in the outfield.
It's both in the game and obviously as a broadcaster. How would they evaluate like the value of playing him at DH, which is obviously significant for his bat, given whatever the downside would be of him aggravating it, running the bases? Do you know what I mean? Is that a decision that like George Springer makes, or ultimately does management sort of make a risk-reward decision here as to what the best play is?
There's an algorithm for that too, Richard. I think they probably run the numbers and say, what are the percentages if he gets hurt at DH as opposed to waiting a few more days? So I don't know. It's just so much a different game than what I'm used to that all you can do is wait until they're in the lineup. I mean, we can't speculate as to what percentage of, 100% healthy, 86% healthy. What is the green light? Is it 78.3% healthy? You get to play, and anything below that you don't? I don't know. And you know what? We just have to take with what we get on the field. When he's on the field, we assume he's healthy. And until he's on the field, you got to assume that he's not healthy enough to play. And they're going to try to get him as many games as possible. And, it's May now. You know, this started back in spring training. You remember, he didn't play right out of the chute in spring training. They were really slow playing him then, and they continued. But, you know, there's no argument about the value of his presence. It changes the personality of the lineup. There's no question about that. But it seems as though we're just going to have to be patient. And when he's in the lineup, that's what we'll accept.
Yeah, Buck, that's a great point. Look, they had their way with Drew Smyly, but my goodness, that lineup, I thought, to me, the acid test was going to be Charlie Morton and Ian Anderson. I know Charlie Morton scuffling a bit this year, and Ian Anderson, I guess, kind of likewise, but there's not much doubt that Ian Anderson's one of the real good young pitchers in the game. And that lineup was terrifying. That's the only way to describe it. I wasn't surprised. But, Buck, I don't know if I've seen a lineup look that terrifying. I'm thinking maybe going back to 2015.
Yeah, I think you're right. The balance of the lineup, despite not having a whole lot of left-handed pop in the lineup, I think is really good, and they're good hitters. And you know what? What tells me everything you need to know about this lineup is look at the number of walks Vladdy has taken. And Vladdy is a different hitter now. And Vladdy understands that He doesn't have to be the star of this team. He doesn't have to be the guy that knocks in all the runs. There are plenty of bats in the lineup now. But somebody's going to have to hit. And I think the real good news this last week was how quickly Teoscar looks like Teoscar. I mean, he missed, like, 14 games. He comes back, hits a home run, he gets some big at-bats. He's got to be a presence behind Vladdy. So they can't simply walk him, you know, three or four times a game. And it appears as though he's going to be that presence. And, gosh, we can't forget what Randall Grichuk has done. What a transformation he has gone through. And, you know, you used to be able to cock your wrist and just show him you're throwing a breaking ball and he was an out. Mm-hmm. That's not the case anymore. He's as good a hitter as there is in the lineup right now. And getting big hits, going the other way, hitting the ball on the ground through the right side. He's doing everything you want from a hitter. And to his credit, all he heard all spring long was, well, it's too bad. Randall's going to be the odd man out. Randall's going to be the odd man out. Well, Randall made sure that he's not the odd man out. That's for sure. And you can bet Charlie's going to continue to play him because he has earned that right. And, you know, sooner or later, we'd like to see Randall back in right field. That's where he is at his best defensively. But you know what? You're right. This is a good lineup. When it's all intact, everything is pretty tough. And it's a tough lineup for pitchers to work their way through.
Yeah, right now that Grichuk contract looks really good, Buck. It's a good point. Before I ask you about the A's, who kind of been pretty interesting in the start they had, minor league baseball is returning. And if you are a Blue Jays fan, man, there are some really interesting things to watch at all levels, but really particularly Double A, where the guys, Buck, that are there now, it has a little bit of, you know, that Bo Vladdy Cavan feel, right?
Right. It's a Double A is going to be a good test. And obviously you're sending some guys there. Austin Martin is going there and he should go there. You know, he's a college player. Didn't play last year. So you know, let's push these guys forward. But I think Double A is a good spot to really focus on this year. I'm really interested in watching Alec Manoah pitch at Triple A. I think Alec is going to come very fast. I think he's a grown up. He showed that in spring training. He's not in awe. He understands that, you know, he's got to be good to get big league hitters out, but he was. And I think he needs to pitch. He hasn't pitched very much. We'd like to see him out on the mound and pitch, but he can pitch. He's got a fastball that goes in two different directions. He's got a very good breaking ball. So I'm anxious to see what he can do, and I'd like to see him have four or five real good starts down in AAA, and then it's going to put pressure on the front office to decide what they're going to do with Alec Manoah, because this team needs more starters. There's no question about that. You can't continue to expect this bullpen to pitch as well as they have, given the workload they've had to endure through the first month of the season.
And, Buck, I'm wondering, you know, I understand that everybody has their own analytical – you know, they've got their own analytics department, but I also know that baseball people do copy each other. And I, you know, noticing that the Kansas City Royals have called up Daniel Lynch to start tonight, and their general manager, Dayton Moore. Look, they've been very aggressive with the three college pitchers out of that 2018 draft. Brady Singer was up last year. He's up this year. Chris Bubich, I think, is how you pronounce his name. They optioned him down to the minors on March 19th. They brought him up, and they're putting him out of the bullpen. And, you know, Dayton Moore, I listened in one of his Zoom calls yesterday, and Dayton Moore said, look, team's got the best record in the majors right now. We talked to the coaching staff. We talked to our development people. I kind of owe it to this team to do what I can within the organization to give us a chance to win. And he said, we'll try this in May and we'll reevaluate and we'll pivot off that. But I was sitting there, and I understand, you know, drafted at different times, but Buck, Daniel Lynch hasn't thrown an inning above single A either. You know, that was his last outing. They've had him in the Arizona Fall League. He's been at the alternate site. They used him in spring training, kind of the way the Jays did Alec Manoah. And I hear that, and I'm thinking, man, it wouldn't surprise me if Alec Manoah is up here. And why not if they're college pitchers?
Well, but let me say one thing about Nate Moore. Nate Moore is a John Schuerholz disciple, right?
Mm-hmm.
So John Schuerholz's saying was always, it takes you 60 games to evaluate where you are.
Yep.
So they're going to take the month of May, and, oh, yeah, by the way, that gets you about 60 games, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you have an idea of who you have. So why wouldn't you bring up your young prospects and give them to what is supposed to be your best pitching coach in your organization, your major league pitching coach? And why wouldn't you protect him by matching him up when you think you should match him up, and then letting him pitch. And, you know, this is who he's going to have to learn how to pitch to. You can't learn how to pitch to big leaguers pitching in Double A or Triple A. You learn how to pitch to big leaguers in the big leagues. So that's what you have to do. And the shackles have been put on these kids much, much too much and too often. How are you going to find out what they can do unless you test them against the best? And you know what? You guys got, if you throw, you know, I'm getting emotional about this because I really believe in this. You're going to send a kid down to the minor leagues, and he's going to dominate in the minor leagues. And then when he gets to the big leagues, he's going to say, well, that worked for me in the minor leagues. How come it's not working here? Because it's different. Mm-hmm. And if you think a kid is mature enough physically and mentally, bring him up here and let him be around the Ryus, around the Robbie Rays, around the Steven Matz, and let him understand what it is. The Blue Jays did this forever. David Wells, Todd Stottlemyre, Pat Henkin, Jimmy Key, they all came up and pitched out of the bullpen. And yeah, what did they do? They all became great starting pitchers because Bobby Cox and Al Widmar and Galen Sisko, they nurtured them and they protected them and they got them in the atmosphere of the major leagues and let them understand this is how you're going to get guys out. Watch how these guys are doing it. Watch how Steve's doing it. Watch how Clancy's doing it. Watch how Leal's doing it. And you're going to learn from them in this atmosphere. You can't learn that in Double A.
Buck, you know, we don't see the A's a ton. And I wonder if you just have any sort of broad thoughts there. They're leading the West at 17-12. If you would have asked me before the season, probably wouldn't have had the A's at the top of that division, but yet there they are.
You know what? And then they got off to a terrible start. Everybody said, well, this is the year the A's aren't going to be able to perform their magic. Well, you know what? Bob Melvin is a hell of a manager. And he's a guy that just preaches, we believe in our players. We're going to stick with our players. And our players are going to figure it out. And they do. And you know what? I think they have that woe is us attitude, like the world is against us. They play in a terrible ballpark. They don't have many fans. They don't have a big salary, but they play as a team, and they always have under Bob Melvin. And, you know, years ago they had great players, and when they were, you know, the swinging A's back in the 70s and 80s, they were totally different. But now they've got good players that are just baseball players. They know how to win games, and Bob Melvin does a terrific job with them. And this is not going to be an easy series for the Blue Jays. Oakland's always been a tough place to play. And, you know, obviously the big spacious foul territory is going to play differently for the Blue Jays hitters. They just come from TD Ballpark in Dunedin, where everything that's in foul ground pumped up is into the seats and out of play. It's not the case in Oakland. So it's going to be a little different out there. But I know Marcus Semien is really thrilled to be back out in Oakland. That's his hometown, his former team. And I expect him to really continue to swing the bat like he has lately.
You know, and it's not just the impact the foul territory has in you when you're at the plate. Ed Sprague was on Baseball Central. He's the A's director of player development. And he was making the point that for a young team, for a young third baseman, perhaps Kevin Biggio, or a young first baseman, perhaps Vladdy Guerrero Jr., this is going to be a different series defensively for them because there is a lot of territory. You can't give up in any ball. And one of the things Ed said, you know, if you're a young third baseman, that throw to first base, he said, it's almost like you're throwing to a guy on an island because the stands are so far back of first base that there's a real issue with depth perception. And the Minnesota Twins lost a game this year in a throw to first base. And Trevor Plouffe went on social media after it was over, and he played the position. He said, hey, I've been there. He said, that throw under pressure to first base in Oakland, the stands look like they're a mile away to you.
Absolutely. That's a terrific point. And we always used to feel that way when we played there. And, you know, when Tony Fernandez was there and Garth Orange and Rance were playing third base. I mean, that guy, he does look like an island. He looks like he's about 2 feet tall all the way over there, and there's nothing but grass and stands behind him. And if you throw it away, it's going to go forever. So it's a challenging throw. And it's a different ballpark for sure. And certainly, you know, it was a multi-purpose stadium. The Raiders played there for a long time. And it's an unusual configuration. And, you know, the A's know how to play there. And you remember how many times Eric Chavez would run and run and run and run and go into foul ground and make a catch way down by the bullpen. Well, you know, Matt Chapman can do the same thing as Matt Olson can. So it's a fun team to watch. And I know the Blue Jays are going to have a good series out there. I think they're probably going to have starters pitching in this series. So that's a good thing.
You mean they can actually do it, Buck? You can actually get away without having an opener or a bullpen day, please? I don't know if I'm ready for that.
Anthony Kay is going to pitch Wednesday, I believe, and Ryu's going to pitch Thursday, and Matt's in the Ray, and it sounds like a regular rotation to me.
Oh, my God. Well, I'll have to get used to it. Buck, thank you for doing this as always, my friend. Stay safe.
All right. Good to be with you guys. You have a great day.
Take care. That's Buck Martinez, our Blue Jays voice on Sportsnet. 9:37. They're on the West Coast, folks. You're going to have to stay up late. Steven Matz against Frankie Montas. Montas. Cole Irvin on the mound. He's a left-hander for the A's against possibly Anthony Kay. That seems to be the way the Jays are going to go. Robbie Ray against Chris Bassett on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the suggestion is that it'll be Hyunjin Ryu coming off the IL to take on Mike Fiers. And that is, I think that's 3:37. I think it's 6:37 our time as the Jays are out on the West Coast. Then it's off to play Houston for three games. And this will be, it's funny. Thinking back, Richard, to the start of the year, and after it, a couple of weeks into the season, it became obvious, I think, that the American League East was probably going to be a little closer than a lot of us thought. You know, Baltimore's had a decent start. They'll likely go away. But Boston, I think, is better than a lot of people thought it did. And one of the points, I think it might have been Kevin Barker made this point, that you may get to this division may be decided, in fact, by how the AL East teams play against the NL East teams when they get into interleague play. You know, the Jays have done pretty well so far. They've laid down a marker against interleague teams, sweeping Atlanta and splitting with the Nationals. So if that's the case, that's a pretty good start.
Yeah, I thought the sweep of the Braves, Jeff, is big. I know it's early in the year, but you know that's a pretty good team, and that was a statement sweep. Again, the Springer thing sort of hangs over everything, but I'm telling you, I heard you early today on Good Show, and I know what Vegas put down in terms of the marker for the Jays, you know, maybe 83, 84 wins or something like that. But I see them closer to the 88, 89, particularly if they make a move for a starting pitcher, and I absolutely expect that. I don't think this division is so great, and that's why I think the number of wins for the Jays, at least in my opinion, may be a little bit higher than what Vegas had for them earlier.
See, I look at it differently. I think the tougher the division, the less likely you are to win. You know, because I don't think the Boston Red Sox are the easy mark we thought they'd be. I think we thought
they're
that
not,
they're...
The Yankees and the Rays aren't world beaters, so I think you're going to get more wins out of those series than you might have expected before the year started.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's going to be a four-way race, and I think it's going to take less to win the division, perhaps, than we originally thought. But again, if you are the Blue Jays, you got the Braves when they were down. You got the Braves when they aren't hitting particularly well, had some injuries as well, and you might as well take advantage of it. And
the A's, I know the A's are off to a good start. This is a winnable series. The A's are not a juggernaut.
Well, they're pretty good. They're decent. They're as good as the Jays. I mean, it's all going to come
down to
it's all going to come down to the starting pitching. I think they're a better defensive team, and I think it's going to come down to the starting pitching.
Yeah, we'll see how it plays out.
It's going to come down to the starting pitching. I think it always does. We'll take a break and get you set for Tim and Friends. This is Writer's Block. Tim and Sid are just around. No, not Tim and Sid. Tim and Friends. Hard to break old habits. Tim and Friends are just around the corner. Chris Johnson, Ricky Romero, Kenny Smith, and Mike Weir back from the dead. She won a golf tournament. I have no idea what it was called, but he won a golf tournament. They will join Tim and Friends at 5 o'clock today. So there you go, Mr. Deitch. Buck Martinez suggesting, I think very clearly, that he does not expect George Springer to play tonight, to DH or play tonight in the first of four games against Oakland. Long flight. I'm sure that may have part to do with it, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm getting tired of telling people. I understand 6 years, as I say, 6 years is a long time. And I understand that people in this city, when it comes to long-term Blue Jays contracts, still have this image of Vernon Wells' contract in their head. Just these are different times. There are different people involved in this decision-making process. But I think, as Buck pointed out, I think ultimately it comes down to George Springer. And you know what? If it's the first couple of months of a six-year contract, Richard, I have no problem letting George Springer kind of call the ball here, because I want George Springer to be how. I don't want this to end the way Josh Donaldson and Aaron Sanchez and, to a certain degree, Russell Martin ended, right?
Relax. Relax. As you said, Blair, and it's painful to agree with you as much as I am here, but it's the no-brainer of no-brainers. The guy is a long-term investment. We're 27 games into the season. Whatever is going on with the guy, let him be as healthy as possible before he goes back and plays. He's not a long-term injury risk based on his previous body of work. He's obviously got something going on. Let this thing heal, and when he comes back, he gave you a glimpse in the Braves series. So I'm totally with you, Blair. Like, patience.
Yeah.
He's this guy's not going to be injured forever. I promise.
And I think it's pretty clear, as we've said, that teams are really erring on the side of caution this year when it comes to injuries.
As they should. These are $100 million investments.
You know, it's going to be around for 162 this year, not just 60. So
exactly.
I'm with you in that. I have no problem. Everybody take a deep breath. Join Tim and Friends.